Well, good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the last live streaming session of the conference here. And this one we put together on purpose. This wasn't anything that was solicited. It was an idea that we came up with at headquarters, and I sort of pursued it, found some speakers, and we had looked through the program and saw there was really nothing specifically on the California drought. And so we thought, well, that seems to be a hole if we're, you know, putting on a conference in California. And so I got together this interesting group of people that you're going to hear from this afternoon, and we had some good discussions on how should we do this, how should we present it, what should we present. And so we came up with even the title, because when we were talking through these things, somebody said, water is going to become more valuable than land. And I thought, wow, that's a key point. And so we ended up naming the session after that particular comment. And so hopefully what you're going to hear today is some insights from the people that are in California. They're working with this. I'm looking forward to the panel discussion at the end where we can really have a conversation about what's going on, what maybe are some of the solutions that we can talk about, and things like that. But to start us off, I invited Damien Field and Alex McBratney from Australia because they're looking at the subject of soil security. And so I wanted that more global perspective to sort of start this thing off, and then we're going to get into our California people and hear what they have to say. So with that, instead of listening to me, I would rather have you listen to the people that are here to talk. So I will let Dr. Damien Field from the University of Sydney start us off.
Yes, thank you, Dawn, for that introduction, and thank you for everyone to be inviting me to speak at this session. And I do see some faces in the room that I've seen earlier this morning, so some of it will be what you've seen before, obviously, and there might be some new information. As Dawn said, I'm going to talk more about the concept of soil security and look at it more from a global point of view rather than the California perspective, because of course there are many people in the room who are going to talk, and many people in the room have much more expertise than I do in that issue, and we're going to hear from them later. So basically, as I go through this talk, we're going to talk about the concept, probably then look at how the concept relates to food security and also water security at the basic level, and maybe what the future holds in developing this further. And where this concept really hit the ground, I suppose, was when we were looking at some of the larger global challenges, and these are discussed locally, they're discussed nationally, and they're discussed internationally. So, you know, whether you're talking at the UN level or the international level or FAO or, you know, at federal level and within country. People are looking at these, and food security, as many people know, has had a long history, and people have focused on, you know, its availability, and then they moved on to quality, you know, making sure that food is nutritious, so it wasn't just the amount that was available. And then as time went on, people started looking at the economics, the opportunity for food. Did people have access to food? Did they either grow it themselves or they had to buy it in? And there was also in the use area, educational use. Do people know how to use food? You know, lack of nutrition or malnutrition in the developing world, as some people say, you know, maybe over-nutrition in the developed world. Okay, but also at the same time, you've had these emerging topics about water security and energy sustainability or energy security. Now, once again, they're about access and use in those areas. And in water security, you know, the link, food security, the link with soil, I think is quite obvious. But with water security, it's about, you know, people know about the functions, about storing water. People talk about transforming, cleaning water, etc. And with energy security, I think there's probably two aspects there that are interesting. One is that there's the above ground issues, biofuels, for example. There's talk whether land should be used to produce fuel rather than food in some areas. And also the below ground issues that in my home country, some of the areas where coal and coal seam gas is available is also under the best producing soil or agricultural soil. So there are tensions that develop between that and concerns because they're worried about water contamination. So it links back to water security. There's also the issues of climate change, which many carbon sequestration has been talked about a long time, and what soils can play in that and its role in climate change. And also biodiversity protection. More and more there's this understanding of not only the above ground biodiversity but also the below ground biodiversity and how that interacts and how soil is a home for that. I think there's also an emerging discussion about human health, and I'm talking beyond just food. The pharmaceutical industries are looking at the next set of gene pools are to do with the soil biota, to look at opportunities to, you know, develop future medications. And also, one thing that I think we'll see when we look at the soil functions that's emerging is there's also that aspect of human health that soil provides environments where people can actually relax, people can take pleasure, people can enjoy themselves, which probably wasn't discussed as intensely many years ago. So that's also another quality of human health, that soil plays a role. Now, the reason that soil's in the centre, okay, I'll say soil's in the centre because I think it's important. Of course, I'm a soil scientist and I think it should be the centre of any discussion. But the reason I also think soil's in the centre is it's linked to all of those other dimensions, all those other, issues, by the functions that it provides. And we'll look at those a little bit later. So if you optimise the functions for food security, you have to consider, are you compromising the functions that might be affecting biodiversity? And we do see examples of that where people have looked at the change in biodiversity in agricultural systems or monoculture systems as compared to diverse systems. So sometimes optimising the function for one will compromise the function for the other. So I think the nice thing about this framework is it's asking me as a soil scientist or other people to engage with it when they're looking at their functions to try and reconcile it with the other components in the system and speak with people to look at the impacts. So that's the, you always have to have a formal definition for something to give it legs, right? That's the formal definition, and I think it's pretty much sums up what I said earlier, but for some people they might look at that and say there's been similar definitions before, soil health, soil quality, you know, there are relationships between those and this concept. But I think security here is used in the same sense that it's used for food, water, which means I think it can start having a currency with those outside the soil science community. Because these other concepts of security have been established. It is part of the narrative. People actually understand that. So I think that is something to be aware of. But more importantly, I think, and this is where I'd like to focus much of the talk, it's always remembering these functions. Now you'll notice here there are seven functions, and for some of you, they may look a little bit different to what you've seen before. These are quite recent, in the last 2006. Before that, for example, biomass production and storage, filtering and transformation used to be divided over six functions in the first iteration. So they've now been coalesced into one. So they would separate that soils stored and filtered water, then soils also decontaminated, etc., etc. So I think that's something to note. Biodiversity, of course, is now recognised as a function where before it wasn't really touched on in the earlier iterations during the soil quality, soil health days when those discussions started in the 90s and the early 2000s. But you'll notice there's physical and cultural environment, an archive for cultural heritage, and acting as a carbon pool. So these are quite recent. And I heard in a talk on Wednesday, a question came from the audience was, are we just going to focus on the biophysical and what soil can produce? What about the other human functions? Well, they're there. It's just whether we're going to evaluate them or put a value on them. That's probably the question for us. And of course, a source for raw materials, my co-author, Alex, and that we always laugh and think that even though it's a function, we might think it makes soil very insecure because it could be dug up and made into something else. But it is one of the functions that's looked at. Okay, and I think we just need to keep those in mind because as we go through the talk, I think that's what we're probably going to use to evaluate security, what we're probably going to try and maximise when we're evaluating security, and what we're probably going to try and put a value on when we're looking at this soil security issue. But before I go any further with the soil security, obviously for the food security there's these widely accepted pillars. If anything comes from the FAO or the UN, it has to have a pillar. Not necessarily a plinth, but you have to have at least pillars. Okay? And I'm sorry, and I say pillars because I say pillars and people think I'm saying pillow. Okay, my R is not as strong. Okay? So I do apologise. And as I said earlier, it is about availability, having a sufficient quantity, and a reliable source of food. And we know in developing nations this is the issue. Reliability is the issue. It's not just the quantity. Having access, so the quality and nutritious food. And as I said earlier, you know, people can have too much nutrition, so they're getting obesity problems as opposed to malnutrition problems. That's being looked at. And then use. So that's more about the education. But also you'll notice with use, they do once again refer to functions that soil's going to provide, and that is helping to minimise contamination, you know, making sure it's a sanitised environment and having enough water to grow the product. So soil does play a role in all of those. And I'm not going to dwell on these in detail, but, you know, the food security people themselves have dimensions that they work through. And interestingly, I just want to point this out, though, they generally focus on something about policy. Well, you know, they focus on, it's about production, it is about use, what people, how people use it, how they gain things, and it's about markets. So they're the common broader dimensions. And in the sustainability dimension, if we look at the availability, access and utilisation, you can see that soil is mentioned, and also aspects related to soil, i.e. production systems, plant breeding systems, GMO, that would be related to soil in those areas. So soil itself is already embedded in this discussion, even if not spoken about explicitly. I will add the caveat, normally at the higher levels when it's discussed as land. I don't have a problem with the term land, but land includes topography, it includes climate, it includes geology. It's not a soil specific, it's not talking specifically about soil. So one of the things I am passionate about is making sure that people distinguish, are they talking about land or those other dimensions, or are they talking about soil? So it's something I'm passionate about, if you like. So in relation to the food security pillars and the soil functions, as you can see there, when we did some of this original writing, we focused obviously on biomass production and the storage and filtering of nutrients, because they were, I think, the obvious ones. They're the production functions. I mean, there are other functions that people could argue are related to that. People who are looking at biodiversity should say there should be a relationship there. But I think these are the obvious ones to people who work in this area. But to help study these functions, because I think looking at the soil functions and then looking at this big concept of food security, there's quite a distance between those. So we need some way to, I think we needed a structure in the middle, some way which we can aggregate, because one of the problems with the focus so far is we're looking at the biophysical quite often. Many of the talks I would have seen here are focusing on the biophysical aspects, and so they should, because that's what soil scientists, crop scientists, etc. do. I have no problem with that. And I often hear people say we should talk to the policy people, which I know here you do have policy advocate groups, but in other countries they're not as well developed, these advocacy groups. You should talk to the policy people. What's the value of soil? What's the value of what is coming from? And how disconnected I often hear people are with soil. They don't know about soil. You know, there's this general acceptance of this disconnectedness. And in Australia, I can argue that might be quite large. As I said to the group this morning, 60% of the population live in three cities in Australia. So there's not many people out there who are really close to the soil. They're in an urban jungle. So I'm going to go through some of these dimensions as we go through the talk. But first I'll just focus on the biophysical dimensions. We've got capability and condition. And the reason my colleagues and I have distinguished this particular dimension is we think we need to have an understanding about what the soil can do, or the question of whether the soil can do this. And I'll explain that a little bit more. I think they're two important questions to keep in mind. Capability, I think it does have in history. Most people here would know something called land capabilities, and I'll discuss a little bit more about that. And I think there is some relationship with land capabilities, but I think we need to evolve that further, that relationship, and I'll talk about why. And then condition, I think, is more about the soil now, what the soil is now, how it's being used now, what it can do now, rather than, you know, what its broader spec. I think capability too recognises one important thing. We know something about soil. If someone gives us some basic properties about soil, we can already infer some information. And I do say that because I do work with colleagues, other NGOs in Cambodia, in Laos, and they just see soil as a series of properties. And if I said, they'll say to me, for example, the soil has this clay content, pH below 4, and has aluminium toxicities. What can I just throw some compost on there to fix it? So it's understanding, and where I'll look at it as a buffered system and seeing how that's actually going to work. So I think people need to be aware that we do know something so we can infer some things about soil. So just quickly, the land capabilities. I mean, all I want to say here is that it does have a history, and the reason the land capabilities worked is because they're systemic. It means that we can map properties, we can look at economics, we can look at socioeconomic issues, and we can put them into polygons and we can map out areas. The one thing I will make a note about land capabilities, whether it's here in Australia or in developing nations, obviously you've got soils that say are unrestricted, they can do anything, or you've got soils that are only forest soils. Okay, and I was speaking to some colleagues here, and they said, we would never crop our forest soils. In Asia, they would, because they've got no option. So I think people need to be mindful of that from a global perspective. But the thing about capabilities, they're often focused very much on production. Whether they can produce or can't produce. And in that production, there's always about, the capabilities are what it can produce, how costly is it to produce, i.e. manage it, and is it easy to manage? And that's how you basically get your categories from unrestricted to this should not be disturbed and just kept as a wetland. And that's generally how they work. But there are indicators in there, soil indicators that are used. Okay, and we all know them, and that we know they're used for different reasons, because we can infer from that water holding capacity, we can infer whether it's easy to work, such as stoniness, or whether stoniness is going to damage root crops, for example. You know, it's going to damage the flesh, which means the visual quality is not there, it's not saleable. Sorry, I keep moving away from this mic, don't I? Yeah. Anyway, but as I said, once a capability class has been judged, we are really asking this question, what can the soil do? And I think what we need to realise then, that is a multifunctional question. We're not saying the soil will grow this crop, or the soil will hold this water, or the soil should be used for this national park or conservation area. It is a multifunctional question in the class. And I think that's important, because that means when we're looking at our soil functions, we're probably trying to look at all of those in this case and see which ones are maximised and which ones aren't. There is a question I won't dwell on, do we need a reference state? And I brought this up this morning. You know, there is an idea that capabilities are a broad concept. Do we actually then need to find an exemplar, a local exemplar in an area, so people can look at something and say this is the functions for this soil, or here's an example of a soil that is functioning well in many of these dimensions, or what this soil can do. So the biophysical dimensions. You know, we need to consider the capability of soil with respect to the soil functions. I think that's clear. And that's one take-home message I'd like people to have today. And the loss or gain in multifunctionality will let us make a judgment on its current condition. So this is what I mean by having a reference state. So we can make some sort of judgment. The other biophysical dimension on condition is once these functions have been decided, so it might be a class 1, 2, 3, 6 or 7 or 8, as you can see the different uses of the soil that would occur under those classes, by looking at the soil indicators or properties again, we then might make a judgment, can the soil do this? Does it have the right pH conditions, nutrient status, etc., to be able to manage this crop? That to me, that is soil health, that's what soil quality is doing, these aspects already, and I think they're doing it well. Okay, so I think that's the difference between this concept and those, that there is no relationship back to this reference state. It is what the soil is now. So I think that's something that needs to be considered. One other thing then is when we define these attributes or we define these functions, I think too we can start thinking about putting a value on the system, which is also important. So we don't just look at the biophysical, we can start looking at a value in the system. So that does bring me to the other three dimensions. Of course, there are three more that I spoke about beyond the biophysical, and these are the socioeconomic dimensions. And for me, this is important because this is a way of starting to dialogue with people who work in these other areas, developing a common language and working out how we understand each of the systems. Okay. For example, we may want, I would argue at the moment, much value placed on soil is very much a production function. That's a lot of how soil is valued. Okay, and that's what's used. People in ecosystem services do put other values on soil, but I know then that brings about arguments. My question is, do we have to value all the ecosystem services? I don't know. We might accept that some ecosystem services don't need to be valued when we're looking at a soil, but we need to work with economists to reason that part of the conversation out. Connectivity has education in it, as well as how people connect it, and of course codification, well, that relates to policy or, in our case in Australia, also then regulation, depending which term you like to use. So from the value, just looking at it as a non-economist, but when I speak to my economists, they always want me to remember a couple of things. They want me to remember that quite often I'm valuing a soil looking at it from its direct use. So what I'm getting out of the soil, the nutrients, etc., or what I have to put in to support the soil. I may look at the indirect use. I may look at riparian zones, etc., around the edge of the farm, lakes on the farm to help clean water, etc., in that area. And that's very much in the production area. There is also this other area, which is existence use or bequest use. Now, existence use or bequest use, I think, would be more fundamental to soils that are, or land that's in land class 7 or 8, i.e. land they say is very restricted, shouldn't be used for cropping or production, should be kept as a conservation area. That's the existence value. That's also links to where human health would come in, because those existence areas may be that's where people go for recreation and what value they place on that. So I think people need to look at that. And bequest value, of course, is do you want to preserve something now because you know it's going to be used in the future? And a classic example of that is carbon sequestration. That's why people are put, should we sequester it? What value needs to be put on it? Because it's about conserving a climate interaction into the future. The option use is probably the most interesting one for an economist, because it's, okay, this is what you're doing now, but what could you do? Have you looked at the alternates? Can you move on to something else? So these are some relevant questions, you know. How do the indirect uses or direct uses affect the option value? What are the indicators? What are the dimensions of the condition? And how do you estimate those? What value do you put on them? Because they have to be seen as a stock. To work in economics, I believe, they've got to be tradable. They've got to have some value that's tradable. Otherwise, it doesn't quite function. And the one big question is, do we place a value on all or some of the seven functions, and can we do it, and how can we do it? Because that connects it back to the soil with these bigger issues. People have been working on this. Dominati, who was doing some work in New Zealand, has been doing some work on this and went through and looked at some provisioning, regulating services, provisioning services, and what she called some social services of the soil, and looked at various indicators that could be used to value that. She did do some work for a dairy production system, where she looked at some of the input costs and the earning costs of that system. And I think she came up with a value over a 35-year period, running through simulation models over 35 years for production, a value of about $16,000 per hectare. When I spoke to my economist, they said, you obviously didn't put your ecosystem services in there because that's too cheap. They said that's a production function. So they reckon we were undervaluing the soil from their perspective. So I think that's something that says to me there's a gap here, okay, with the way we traditionally engage with the soil. Connectivity. All I wanted to mention here is this is another challenging area, how people are connected with the system. I'm going to suggest here that maybe carbon is something that we could look at, soil carbon. Last year in a conference we spoke about this, because the general public knows what carbon is. They already have some understanding of it. So if we use carbon as an indicator, if carbon goes below a certain level, the soil will be challenged, but it also can only hold so much, so it might be an indicator that we use. So there's some of the areas that we can look at. And then there's the socioeconomic dimensions. I will mention there is also this other issue about what I call special groups. I will say this, in Australia we have these things called special groups, and what that means is this is where soil is secured, in want of a word, because it's used for vineyard production, or it's used for horse breeding. So it's not the soil attributes that secure the soil, it protects it from other uses because there's a concentration of a group of people. So there can be those socioeconomic dimensions that codify a soil for use and stop it, say, being used for mining, because these areas were actually being challenged by mining. So this is a way to stop mining in the area. So it had nothing to do with the value or the soil. Does that make it more secure? I don't know. Are these people managing the soil properly? I'm not sure. So that's a question, a sub-question under that. Water security. Okay, so once again, you've got your quality, you've got your scarcity, you've got your cooperation. These are the dimensions that you're looking at in the water security area. Not very different. I think the thing to note is these are the big questions I think that are being asked. What's the relationship between land use and water use? If water becomes too expensive, can you grow something? So does the land use change, and what value does that put on the land use? If it's no longer useful for production, you know, in that area, if you can't get a license or the quantity of water that you need. What are the trade-offs between that in the area? So that's where I would say the capital's coming into it, and probably some of the connectivity. And what are the social and institutional arrangements? So from my dimensions, it's about the connectivity and it's about the codification that would be asking those questions. Once again, these are the functions, very similar, except I've put biodiversity in here too, because I think it is something that is considered, because water supplying in riparian zones, river systems, etc. So it is maintained for that. And you'll hear later there are different types of water, okay, that people can look at. Blue water, green water. So green water is basically evapotranspiration through the plant. Blue water can be used for irrigation, but it's mainly used for us in river systems as well. Okay, so there's a tension between those. Just quickly, the global water footprint, you can see the usage around the world. So that represents the water use, and funnily enough, it aligns very much with the agricultural areas around the world and the intensity of the agriculture as well. One thing that's interesting, though, is water is often looked at a local level, maybe at a state level or a province level. Rarely is it regulated at a national level. We're just starting to do that now, where we're trying to regulate it, so it's very much a state issue, and that affects how it's moved. And internationally, it's very rarely looked at as how it's moved around, or its quantities, or how it's used. An example of that is now things like the virtual water balance are coming about. How much water is going with your grain when you sell it overseas? How much water are you importing with food products you're bringing in? So these accounts are starting to be developed. And that's just a quick representation of this blue and green water, the idea of the nodes. So basically people are arguing you need to keep blue water at a particular level for human consumption and to support river systems and ecosystems. It's not all about going through the crop or the plant. So that's what they're trying to build up. So there have been various water balance and land use focuses, because one of the challenges to yield, as we know, beyond fertilizers is being able to provide water, one of the limiting factors. And all this graph saying here is that if you look at the x-axis, it's saying what percentage of the total green water is actually going through the crop. You know, what's not being lost somewhere else, for example, through evaporation. So it has actually been transpired. And the one on the side is how much water is actually there or caught in the system, i.e. not lost due to runoff or not lost due to percolation. So this was some work done in Africa, and they've basically worked out these different degrees, and these increases in proportionalities will have relative increases in yield. So from the soil point of view, how are we contributing to that? Well, I think many of you would say it's quite obvious that, you know, it's about moderating runoff or controlling runoff, but also creating a balance with that. So that, and that's also about surface condition, furrows and ponding. So that's been looked at here and talked about in many other sessions. Change the water storage, soil structure, manage the drainage, make sure there's enough drainage to not build up salts, but not that you're losing a lot of it. But then there's also the breeders options, where they'll look at crop choice, plant available water, water use efficiency, irrigation options, as well as drought tolerance, root volume and canopy. So they're contributions that I think we can make from the biophysical point of soil, and probably focus on the first two functions, one and two, that we identified earlier. There's also a need to focus on the other functions. So we need to, I think, maybe look, can we move away from just production functions in this area, beyond gross margins. So, and there's also this idea of what they call the merchantable or retainable asset. So economists will look at how is the land valued in relation to what it can do. So water is one of those aspects that will influence that. If you don't have a water license, you don't have the volume of water, the value of the land is increased by something else. Maybe it's subdivision planning, etc. That's what would happen in Australia anyway. Not sure about here. And then, of course, we also need this idea that we need to have some decent knowledge going out there. And I think extension's still valuable, but extension in Australia is losing currency as a word, I must say. People are looking, and it's only because of the way the extension services are changing. Not that they're still good, but I think its currency is changing. And it's also about positioning soil in policy. And I think we have to start looking at whether we can put a value on this existence or bequest value in the public good, so we're moving away from those production functions as an opportunity. So, going back to my questions for the water security, I could see these are the dimensions, the soil security dimensions that I think could contribute, and then the functions would work under those. They would give a set that which the functions could work in those areas. Just a reminder that, once again, these are the dimensions. I think we do the first set very well, and we know a lot about them. I think to do the last set well, it's about bringing the others in and working more closely. And I'm sure we're going to hear talks today of people in the room who are doing this already in some of these areas. So basically, this is our set that we're going to look at, and we're developing over time. We don't know how to quantify this yet, but this is what we are looking at. So I'm not saying this is the equation, if you like, but I think to secure a soil, you have to try and make sure that you are optimising, if you like, for not maximising necessarily, but optimising each of those dimensions to some respect, and within those, the functions in the dimensions. And that's what we need to look at in the future. I'll skip over that, but that was just reinforcing once again the idea of these functions. You can see there's a connection of functions. And to develop this concept further, this will be my last slide, we've chosen America to be the lead, and it's in Texas. Okay, what's going to happen in Texas, there is the first of the Global Soil Security Symposiums, where at that symposium, it will not just be soil scientists and crop agronomists, etc. We will also made contact, and we know there will be people who are working in the social science area, the economics area, and the policy area. So we can actually run sessions and actually get people to talk around these issues and see if any of this can be actualised. But thank you very much. Thank you for the invitation.
We have just a few minutes for a couple of questions. We have to use a mic because we're live streaming and people online won't be able to hear you if you don't talk into the mic. So if you have questions, just raise your hand. I'll bring the mic to you. It is warm.
That means you have to ask one, Dawn. That's okay.
Here's a question for you that has to do with the session.
Yes.
How much of a problem has drought been in Australia? I know you've had, like last summer was very warm, because I know I've talked to you through Skype and things like that, and there's been a lot of complaints it's way hot and it's way dry. And so how is Australia dealing with some of that?
There's a couple of responses Australia's made to that. One is, I'd say there's probably two main areas. One is, was a big review of the water licensing program, and that was done during a drought or just after an 8-year drought, which, because our river systems go from the north and actually flow inland and out through the south of the continent, so they don't actually just flow straight to the coast. So decisions made in Queensland affect decisions in other states. So the response to that was they actually looked at a buyback program and developing a national protocol to deal with water allocation through the different states. Where the problem arose, Dawn, was they focused very much on the biophysical. So they had all the scientific data and they came up with this is what the water balances should be, and all the farmers had a day of what they call burn the books. So they actually responded really badly to it, and another year of actual consultation with the growers in the area, they realised that was something that needs to be done. You just can't ignore that there's a group of people here, even if the science says this. So there is a policy gone through now, but I think it's been a bit more consultative. So it's actually picked up on those dimensions. The second area is the current government is now looking at a lot of more options for drought proofing. So they're looking at the opportunities to build more water storage capacity. So it actually has brought that discussion up. So drought hasn't gone away. This is being recorded, but I don't know if they're being very creative in some of their options. I'll say that in some of their options, but they are looking at that, and there is actually a green paper driven once again, even though we're in a non-drought period, about this water use efficiency. The big challenge we have in areas where there are some options for water use, disease pest management is the crucial problem. And that's in the north of Australia. There's a huge pest pressure. So, you know, there's enough water, but it's how you manage those pest pressures which are quite difficult.
Well, thank you. And with that, we're going to move on. But Damien will be back for the panel discussion if you think of a question you'd like to ask.
Thank you. Thanks very much.